situation, Ruth stepped out of the car and walked toward the grocery store, still thinking. 9. Mom's doctor. And she started to count on her fingers the questions she should ask the doctor. Thank God she could speak once again. In the vegetable aisle, Ruth headed toward a bin of beautifully shaped turnips. They were each the size of apples, symmetrical and scrubbed, with striations of purple. Most people did not appreciate the aesthetics of turnips, Ruth thought as she chose 5 good ones, whereas she loved them, their crunchiness, the way they absorbed the flavor of whatever they were immersed in, gravy or pickling juice. She loved cooperative vegetables, and she loved turnips best when they were sliced into wedges and preserved in vinegar and chilies, sugar and salt. Every year before their family reunion dinner in September, her mother started 2 new fermenting jars of spicy turnips, one of which she gave to Ruth. When Ruth was a little girl, she called them Lala, hot, hot. She would suck and munch on them until her tongue and lips felt inflamed and swollen. She still gorged on them from time to time. Was it a craving for salt or for pain? When the supply grew low, Ruth would toss in more chopped-up turnips and a pinch of salt and let them pickle for a few days. Art thought the taste was okay in small doses, but the girls said they smelled like something farted in the fridge. At times, Ruth secretly ate the spicy turnips in the morning, her way of seizing the day. Even her mother considered that strange. Her mother. And Ruth tapped her ring finger to remind herself again of the doctor's appointment. 4 o'clock. She had to squeeze a lot of work into the shortened day. She hurried, grabbing Fuji apples for Fia, Granny Smiths for Dory, Brayburns for Art. At the meat counter, she evaluated the options. Dory would not eat anything with eyes, and ever since seeing that pig movie Babe, Fia had been trying to be a vegetarian. Both girls made an exception for fish, because seafood was not cute. When they announced that, Ruth said to them, "Just because something isn't cute, is its life worth less? If a girl wins a beauty contest, is she better than a girl who doesn't?" And Fia scrunched up her face and replied, "What are you talking about? Fish don't enter beauty contests." Ruth now pushed her cart toward the fish counter. She longed for prawns in the shell, always her first choice. Art wouldn't eat them, however. He claimed that the predominant taste of any crustacean or mollusk was that of its alimentary tract. She settled on Chilean sea bass. "That one," she told the man at the counter. Then she reconsidered. "Actually, give me the bigger one." She might as well ask her mother to dinner, since they were already going to the doctor's together. Luling was always complaining she didn't like to cook for just herself. At the checkout counter, Ruth saw a woman in front of her scoop up bunches of ivory and peach-colored tulips, at least $50 worth. Ruth was amazed at how some people casually bought flowers as household staples, as if they were as necessary as toilet paper. And tulips of all choices. They wilted and dropped their petals after a few days. Was the woman having an important dinner party on a weeknight? When Ruth bought flowers, she had to assess their value in several ways to justify what she bought. Daisies were cheerful and cheap, but they had an unpleasant smell. Baby's breath was even cheaper, but as Gideon pointed out, it was the lowest of floral low taste, what old queens used, along with lace doilies he inherited from their grandmothers. Tuberoses smelled wonderful and gave an architectural touch, but they were expensive at this store, nearly $4 a stalk. At the flower mart, they were only $1. She liked hydrangeas in a pot. They were making a comeback, and while they cost a lot, they lasted a month or two, if you remembered to water them. The trick was to cut them before they died, then let them dry in a pottery pitcher, so you could keep them as a permanent floral arrangement. That is, until someone like Art threw them out, citing that they were already dead. Ruth had not grown up with flowers in the house. She could not remember Luling ever buying them. She had not thought this a deprivation until the day she went grocery shopping with Auntie Gal and her cousins. At the supermarket in Saratoga, 10-year-old Ruth had watched as they dumped into the cart whatever struck their fancy at the moment, all kinds of good things Ruth was never allowed to eat, chocolate milk, donuts, TV dinners, ice cream sandwiches, Hostess Twinkies. Later they stopped at a little stand where Auntie Gal bought cut flowers, pink baby roses, even though nobody had died or was having a birthday. Remembering this, Ruth decided to splurge and buy a small orchid plant with ivory blooms. Orchids looked delicate but thrived on neglect. You didn't have to water them but once every 10 days. And while they were somewhat pricey, they bloomed for 6 months or more, then went dormant before surprising you with new blooms all over again. They never died. You could count on them to reincarnate themselves forever. A lasting value. Back at the flat, Ruth put the groceries away, set the orchid on the dining room table, and went into the cubbyhole. She liked to think that limited space inspired limitless imagination. The walls were painted red with flecks of metallic gold, Wendy's idea. The overhead light was softened by a desk lamp with an amber mica shade. On the lacquer black shelves were reference books instead of jars of jam. A pull-out cutting board held her laptop. A flower bin had been removed for knee space. She turned on her computer and felt drained before she even started. What was she doing 10 years ago? The same thing. What would she be doing 10 years from now? The same thing. Even the subjects of the books she helped write were not that different. Only the buzzwords had changed. She took a deep breath and phoned the new client, Ted. His book, Internet Spirituality, was about the ethics created by cosmic computer connections, a topic he felt sure was hot right now, but would lose its cachet if the publisher didn't get it to market as soon as possible. He had said so in several urgent phone messages he had left over the weekend when Ruth was in Tahoe. "I have nothing to do with arranging publishing dates," Ruth now tried to explain. "Stop thinking in terms of constraints," he told her. "If you write this book with me, you have to believe in its principles. Anything is possible, as long as it's for the good of the world. Make the exception. Live exceptionally. And if you can't do that, maybe we should consider whether you're right for this project. Think about it. Then let's talk tomorrow." Ruth hung up. She thought about it. The good of the world, she muttered to herself, was her agent's job. She would warn Gideon that the client was pushy and might try to change the publication date. She would stand firm this time. To do what the client wanted while meeting her other commitments would require her to work round the clock. 15 years earlier, she could have done that, in the days when she also smoked cigarettes and equated busyness with feeling wanted. Not now. Untense the muscles, she reminded herself. She took another deep breath and exhaled as she stared at the shelves of books she had helped edit and write. The cult of personal freedom, the cult of compassion, the cult of envy, the biology of sexual attraction, the physics of human nature, the geography of the soul, the yin and yang of being single, the yin and yang of being married, the yin and yang of being divorced. The most popular books were Defeat Depression with Dogs, Procrastinate to Your Advantage, and To Hell with Guilt. The last book had become a controversial bestseller. It had even been translated into German and Hebrew. In the co-authoring trade, Ruth Young was a small, tight name that followed with, that is, if it appeared at all. After 15 years, she had nearly 35 books to her credit. Most of her early work had come from corporate communications clients. Her expertise had woven its way into communication in general, then communication problems, behavioral patterns, emotional problems, mind-body connections, and spiritual awakening. She had been in the business long enough to see the terms evolve from chakras to chi, prana, vital energy, life force, biomagnetic force, bioenergy fields, and finally back to chakras. In bookstores, most of her clients' words of wisdom were placed in the light or popular sections, self-help, wellness, inspirational, new age. She wished she were working on books that would be categorized as philosophy, science, medicine. By and large, the books she helped write were interesting, she often reminded herself, and if not, it was her job to make them interesting. And though she might poo-poo her own work just to be modest, it irked her when others did not take her seriously. Even art did not seem to recognize how difficult her job was, but that was partly her fault. She preferred to make it look easy. She would rather that others discern for themselves what an incredible job she did in spinning gold out of dross. They never did, of course. They didn't know how hard it was to be diplomatic. to excavate lively prose from incoherent musings. She had to assure clients that her straightforward recasting of the words still made them sound articulate, intelligent, and important. She had to be sensitive to the fact the authors saw their books as symbolic forms of immortality, believing that their words on the printed page would last far longer than their physical bodies. And when the books were published, Ruth had to sit back quietly at parties while the clients took the credit for being brilliant. She often claimed she did not need to be acknowledged to feel satisfied, but that was not exactly true. She wanted some recognition, and not like the kind she had received 2 weeks before, at the party for her mother's 77th birthday. Auntie Gal and Uncle Edmund had brought along a friend from Portland, an older woman with thick glasses, who asked Ruth what she did for a living. "I'm a book collaborator," she answered. "Why you say that?" Luling scolded. "Sound bad like you traitor and spy." Auntie Gal then said with great authority, "She's a ghostwriter, one of the best there is. You know those books that say, as told to on the cover? That's what Ruth does. People tell her stories and she writes them down, word for word, exactly as told." Ruth had no time to correct her. "Like court stenographers," the woman said. "I hear they have to be very fast and accurate. Did you go through special training?" Before Ruth could answer, Auntie Gal chirped, "Ruthie, you should tell my story. Very exciting, plus all true. But I don't know if you can keep up. I'm a pretty fast talker." Now Lu Ling jumped in. "Not just type, lots work." And Ruth was grateful for this unexpected defense until her mother added, "She corrects spelling, too." Ruth looked up from her notes on her phone conference with the internet spirituality author and reminded herself of all the ways she was lucky. She worked at home, was paid decent money, and at least the publishers appreciated her, as did the publicists who called her for talking points when booking radio interviews for the authors. She was always busy, unlike some freelance writers who fretted over the trickle of jobs in the pipeline. "So busy, so success," her mother had said recently when Ruth told her she didn't have any free time to see her. "Not free," Lu Ling added, "because every minute must charge money. What I should pay you, $5, $10, then you come see me?" The truth was, Ruth did not have much free time, not in her opinion. Free time was the most precious time, when you should be doing what you loved, or at least slowing down enough to remember what made your life worthwhile and happy. Her free time was usually usurped by what seemed at the time urgent and later unnecessary. Wendy said the same thing. "Free time doesn't exist anymore. It has to be scheduled with a dollar amount attached to it. You're under this constant pressure to get your money's worth out of rest, relaxation, and restaurants that are hard to get into." After hearing that, Ruth didn't agonize as much over time constraints. It wasn't her fault she didn't have enough time to do what was necessary. The problem was universal. But try explaining that to her mother. She pulled out her notes for Chapter 7 of Agape Agnos's latest book, Writing the Wrong Child, and punched Agape's number. Ruth was one of the few people who knew that Agape's real name was Doris DiMatteo, that she had chosen her pseudonym because Agape meant love, and Agnos referred to ignorance, which she redefined as a form of innocence. That was how she signed her books, Love and Innocence, Agape Agnos. Ruth enjoyed working with her. Though Agape was a psychiatrist, she didn't come across as intimidating. She knew that much of her appeal was her Zsa Zsa Gabor shtick, her accent, the flirtatious yet intelligent personality she exuded when she answered questions in TV and radio interviews. During their phone meeting, Ruth reviewed the chapter that presented the 5 don'ts and 10 do's of becoming a more engaged parent. "Darling," Agape said, "why does it always have to be a list of 5 and 10? I can't always limit myself to such regular numbers." "It's just easier for people to remember in series of 5s and 10s, Ruth answered. "I read a study somewhere about that." Hadn't she? "It probably has to do with counting on our fingers." "That makes perfect sense, my dear. I knew there was a reason." After they hung up, Ruth began work on a chapter titled No Child is an Island. She replayed a tape of Agape and herself talking. "A parent, intentionally or not, imposes a cosmology on the little child." Agape paused. "You want to say something?" What cue had she given that let Agapi know she wanted to add a thought? Ruth seldom interrupted people. "We should define cosmology here," she heard herself say. "Perhaps in a sidebar. We don't want people to think we're talking about cosmetics or astrology." "Yes, yes, excellent point, my dear. Cosmology. Let's see. What we believe, subconsciously, implicitly, or both, how the universe works. You want to add something?" "Readers will think we mean planets or the Big Bang Theory." "You are such a cynic." "All right, you write the definition, but just include something about how each of us fits into our family, society, the communities we come into contact with. Talk about those various roles, as well as how we believe we got them, whether it's destiny, fate, luck, chance, self-determination, etc., etc. Oh, and Ruth, darling, make it sound sexy and easy to grasp." "No problem." "All right, so we assume everyone understands cosmology. We go on to say that parents pass along this cosmology to children through their behaviors, their reactions to daily events, often mundane." You look puzzled. "Examples of mundane. Mealtime, for instance. Perhaps dinner always happens at 6, and Mom is an elaborate planner. Dinner is a ritual, but nothing happens. No talk, unless it's argument. Or meals are eaten, catch as catch can. With just these contrasts, the child might grow up thinking either that day and night are predictable, though not always pleasant, or that the world is chaotic, frantic, or freely evolving. Some children do beautifully, no matter what the early influences, whereas others grow up into great, big adults who require a lifetime of very, very expensive psychotherapy." Ruth listened to their laughter on the tape. She'd never gone into therapy, as Wendy had. She worked with too many therapists, saw that they were human, full of foibles, in need of help themselves. And while Wendy thought it worthwhile to know that a professional was dedicated to her, and her alone, for 2 one-hour sessions a week, Ruth could not justify spending $150 an hour to listen to herself talk. Wendy often said Ruth should see a shrink about her compulsion with number counting. To Ruth, however, the counting was practical, not compulsive. It had to do with remembering things, not warding off some superstitious nonsense. "Ruth, darling," Agapi's tape voice continued, "can you look at the folder marked Fascinating Case Studies and pick out suitable ones for this chapter?" "Okay, and I was thinking, how about including a section on the cosmology imparted by television as artificial caregiver? Just a suggestion, since it would probably also work as an angle for television shows and radio interviews." "Yes, yes, wonderful. What shows do you think we should do?" "Well, starting with the 50s, you know, Howdy Doody, the Mickey Mouse Club, all the way to The Simpsons and South Park." "No, dear, I mean what shows I might be on. 60 Minutes, Today, Charlie Rose. Oh, I would love to be on that show. That man is so sexy." Ruth took notes and started an outline. No doubt Agapi would call her that night to discuss what she had written. Ruth suspected she was the only writer in the business who believed a deadline was an actual date. Her watch sounded at 11. She tapped her finger. 8. Call Gideon. When she reached him, she began with the demands of the internet spirituality author. "Ted wants me to push everything else aside and make his project top priority under rush deadlines. I was very firm about saying I couldn't do that, and he hinted pretty strongly that he might replace me with another writer. Frankly, I'd be relieved if he fired me," Ruth said. She was preparing herself for rejection. "He never will," Gideon replied. "You'll cave in, you always do. You'll probably be calling Harper San Francisco by the end of the week, persuading them to change the schedule." "What makes you say that?" "Face it, sweetheart, you're accommodating, willing to bend over backward, and you have this knack for making even the dickheads believe they're the best at what they do." "Watch it," Ruth said. "That's a hooker you're describing." "It's true. You're a dream when it comes to collaboration," Gideon went on. "You listen as the clients blather on, egos unchecked. They walk all over you, and you just take it. You're easy." Why wasn't Art hearing this? Ruth wanted to gloat. "See, others don't think I'm difficult." Then she realized Gideon was saying she was a pushover. She wasn't really, she reasoned. She knew her limits, but she wasn't the type to get into a conflict over things that were ultimately not that important. She didn't understand people who thrived on argument and being right all the time. Her mother was that way. And what did that get her? Nothing but unhappiness, dissatisfaction, and anger. According to her mother's cosmology, the world was against her and no one could change this, because this was a curse. But the way Ruth saw it, Luling got into fights mainly because of her poor English. She didn't understand others, or they didn't understand her. Ruth used to feel she was the one who suffered because of that. The irony was, her mother was actually proud she had taught herself English, the choppy talk she had acquired in China and Hong Kong. And since immigrating to the United States 50 years before, she had not improved either her pronunciation or her vocabulary. Yet her sister, Gao Ling, had come to the States around the same time, and her English was nearly perfect. She could talk about the difference between crinoline and organza, name the specific trees she liked, oak, maple, ginkgo, pine. To Lu Ling, cloth was classified as cost too much, too slippery, scratchy skin, and last long time. And there were only two kinds of trees, shady and drop leaf all the time. Her mother couldn't even say Ruth's name right. It used to mortify Ruth when she shouted for her up and down the block, Ludi, Ludi. Why had her mother chosen a name with sound she couldn't pronounce? But this was the worst part. Being the only child of a widow, Ruth had always been forced to serve as Lu Ling's mouthpiece. By the time she was 10, Ruth was the English-speaking Mrs. Lu Ling Young on the telephone, the one who made appointments for the doctor, who wrote letters to the bank. Once she even had to compose a humiliating letter to the minister. Ludi give me so much trouble, Lu Ling dictated, as if Ruth were invisible. Maybe I send her go Taiwan, school for bad children. What you think? Ruth revised that too. Perhaps Ruth might attend a finishing school in Taiwan where she can learn the manners and customs of a young lady. What is your opinion? In an odd way, she now thought, her mother was the one who had taught her to become a book doctor. Ruth had to make life better by revising it. At 3:10, Ruth finished paying the plumber. Art had never come home, nor had he called. A whole new water heater was needed, not just a replacement part. And because of the leak, the plumber had had to shut off the electricity to the entire flat until he had suctioned out the standing water and removed the old tank. Ruth had been unable to work. She was running late. She faxed the outline to Agapi, then raced around the house, gathering notes, her cell phone, her address book. Once in the car, she drove to the Presidio Gate and then through the eucalyptus forest to California Street. Her mother lived 50 blocks west, in a part of San Francisco known as the Sunset District, close to Land's End. The doctor's appointment was ostensibly a routine visit. Her mother had overlooked having an annual checkup for the last few years, though it was included free in her HMO plan. Lu Ling was never sick. Ruth could not remember the last time she had had the flu or even a cold. At 77, her mother had none of the common geriatric problems, arthritis, high cholesterol, or osteoporosis. Her worst ailment, the one she frequently complained about to Ruth in excruciating detail, was constipation. Recently, though, Ruth had some concerns that her mother was becoming not forgetful exactly, but careless. She would say ribbon when she meant wrapping paper, envelope when she meant stamp. Ruth had made a mental list of examples to tell the doctor. The accident last March, she should mention that as well. Lu Ling had bashed her car into the back of a truck. Luckily, she had only bumped her head on the steering wheel and no one else was hurt. Her car was totaled. "Scare me to pieces," Lu Ling had reported. "My skin almost fall off." She blamed a pigeon that had flown up in front of her windshield. Maybe, Ruth now considered, it was not a flutter of wings, but one in her brain, a stroke. And the bump on her head was more serious, a concussion, a skull fracture. Whatever was wrong, the police report and insurance company said it was Lu Ling's fault, not the pigeon's. Lu Ling was so outraged that she canceled her car insurance, then complained when the company refused to reinstate her policy. Ruth had related the incident to Agapi Agnos, who said inattention and anger could be related to depression in the elderly. My mother's been depressed and angry all her life, Ruth told Agapi. She did not bring up the threats of suicide, which she had heard so often she tried not to react to them. I know of some excellent therapists who've worked with Chinese patients, Agapi said. Quite good with cultural differences, magical thinking, old societal pressures, the flow of qi. Believe me, Agapi, my mother is not like other Chinese people. Ruth used to wish her mother was more like Auntie Gao. She didn't talk about ghosts or bad luck or ways she might die. In any case, my dear, you should have a doctor give her a thorough checkup. And you put your arms around her and give that mother of yours a great big healing hug from me. It was a nice thought, but Ruth rarely exchanged embraces with Lu Ling. When she tried, her mother's shoulders turned rigid, as if she were being attacked. Driving toward Lu Ling's building, Ruth entered the typical fog of summer. Then came block after block of bungalows built in the 20s, cottages that sprang up in the 30s, and characterless apartments from the 60s. The ocean view skyline was marred by electrical wires strewn from pole to house and house to pole. Many of the picture windows had sea misty smears. The drain pipes and gutters were rusted, as were the bumpers of old cars. She turned up a street lined with more upscale homes, architectural attempts at Bauhaus sleekness, their small lawns decorated with shrubs cut in odd shapes, like the cotton candy legs of show poodles. She pulled up to Lu Ling's place, a two-unit Mediterranean style with an apricot-colored curved front and a fake bay window balcony with wrought iron grating. Lu Ling had once proudly tended her yard. She used to water and cut the hedge herself, neaten the border of white stones that flanked the short walkway. When Ruth lived at home, she had had to mow the 7x7-foot squares of lawn. Lu Ling always criticized any edges that touched the sidewalk. She also complained about the yellow urine spots made by the dog from across the street.
Ludi, you tell that man don't let dog do that.
Ruth reluctantly went across the street, knocked on the door, asked the neighbor if he had seen a black and white cat, then walked back and told her mother that the man said he would try. When she went away to college and came home to visit, her mother still asked her to complain to the man across the street almost as soon as she walked in the door. The missing cat routine was getting old, and it was hard to think of new excuses for knocking on the man's door. Ruth usually procrastinated, and Lu Ling nagged about more and more yellow spots, as well as Ruth's laziness, her forgetfulness, her lack of concern for family, on and on. Ruth tried to ignore her by reading or watching TV. One day Ruth worked up the courage to tell Lu Ling she should hire a lawyer to sue the man or a gardener to fix the lawn. Her college roommate had suggested she say this, telling Ruth she was crazy to let her mother push her around as if she were still 6 years old. "Is she paying you to be a punching bag?" her roommate had said, building the case. "Well, she does give me money for college expenses," Ruth admitted. "Yeah, but every parent does that. They're supposed to. But that doesn't give them the right to make you their slave." Thus bolstered, Ruth confronted her mother. "If it bothers you so much, you take care of it." Lu Ling stared at her, silent, for 5 full minutes. Then she burst like a geyser. "You wish I dead? You wish no mother tell you what to do? Okay, maybe I die soon." And just like that, Ruth had been upended, flung about, was unable to keep her balance. Lu Ling's threats to die were like earthquakes. Ruth knew that the potential was there, that beneath the surface the tremors could occur at any time. And despite this knowledge, when they erupted, she panicked and wanted to run away before the world fell down. Strangely, after that incident, Lu Ling never mentioned anything about the dog peeing on the lawn. Instead, whenever Ruth came home, Lu Ling made it a point to take out a spade, get on her hands and knees, and painfully dig out the yellow spots and reseed them, 2 square inches at a time. Ruth knew it was her mother's version of emotional torture, but still it made her stomach hurt as she pretended not to be affected. Lu Ling finally did hire someone to take care of the yellow spots, a cement contractor, who constructed a frame and a mold, then poured a patio of red and white concrete diamonds. The walkway was red as well. Over the years, the red diamonds faded, the white ones turned grimy. Some areas looked as though they had experienced the upheavals of Lilliputian volcanoes. Spiny weeds and straw-like tufts grew in the cracks. I should call someone to spruce up the place, Ruth thought as she approached the house. She was sad that her mother no longer cared as much about appearances. She also felt guilty that she had not helped out more around the house. Perhaps she should call her own handyman to do cleanup and repairs. As Ruth neared the steps to the upper unit, the downstairs tenant stepped out of her doorway, signaling that she wanted to speak to her. Francine was an anorexically thin woman in her 30s, who seemed to be wearing a size 8 skin over a size 2 body. She often griped to Ruth about repairs needed for the building. The electricity kept shorting out. The smoke detectors were old and should be replaced. The back steps were uneven and could cause an accident and a lawsuit.
"Never satisfy," Lu Ling told Ruth.
Ruth knew not to take sides with the tenant, but she worried that there might really be a problem, like a fire one day, and she dreaded the headlines. Slum landlady jailed, ignored deadly hazards. So Ruth surreptitiously handled some of the more resolvable problems. When she bought Francine a new smoke detector, Lu Ling found out and became apoplectic.
"You think she right? I wrong?"
As had happened throughout Ruth's childhood, Lu Ling's fury escalated until she could barely speak except to sputter the old threat.
"Maybe I die soon."
"You need to talk to your mom," Francine was now saying in a whiny voice. "She's been accusing me of not paying the rent. I always pay on time, the first of the month. I don't know what she's talking about, but she goes on and on like a broken record." Ruth had a sinking feeling. She did not want to hear this. "I even showed her the canceled check, and she said, 'See, you still have the check.' It was weird, like she wasn't making any sense." "I'll take care of it," Ruth said quietly. "It's just that she's harassing me, like 100 times a day. It's making me nuts. I'll get it straightened out." "I hope so, because I was just about to call the police to get a restraining order."
"Restraining order? Who's the nut here?"
"I'm sorry this happened," Ruth said, and remembered a book she helped write on mirroring a child's feelings. "You must be frustrated when it's clear you've done nothing wrong." It worked.
"Okay, then," Francine said and backed into her doorway like a cuckoo in a Swiss clock.
Ruth used her own key to let herself into her mother's apartment. She heard Lu Ling call to her.
"Why so late?"
Seated in her brown vinyl easy chair, Lu Ling looked like a petulant child on a throne. Ruth gave her a once-over to see if she could detect anything wrong. A twitch in her eye, a slight paralysis, perhaps, on one side of her face. Nothing. The same old mom. Lu Ling was wearing a purple cardigan with gold-toned buttons, her favorite. Black slacks and size 4 black pumps with low heels. Her hair was smoothed back and gathered like Fia's and Dory's, only she had the ponytail wound into a netted bun, thickened with a hairpiece. Her hair was jet black, except for the roots at the back, where she could not see that she had failed to apply enough dye. From a distance, she looked like a much younger woman, 60 instead of 77. Her skin was even-toned and smooth, no need for foundation or powder. You had to stand a foot away before you could see the fine etching of wrinkles on her cheeks. The deepest lines were at the corners of her mouth, which were often turned down, as they were now. Lu Ling groused.
"You say doctor visit 1 o'clock.
"I said the appointment was at 4.
"No, 1 o'clock. You say be ready. So I get ready, you don't come."
Ruth could feel the blood draining out of her head. She tried another tack. "Well, let me call the doctor and see if we can still get in at 4. She went to the back where her mother did her calligraphy and painting, to the room that had been her own long before. On her mother's drawing table lay a large sheet of watercolor paper. Her mother had started a poem painting, then stopped in mid-character. The brush lay on the paper, its tip dried and stiff. Lu Ling was not careless. She treated her brushes with fanatical routine, washing them in spring water, not tap, so that chlorine would not damage them. Perhaps she had been in the middle of painting and heard the tea kettle crying and bolted. Maybe the phone rang after that, one thing after another. But then Ruth looked closer. Her mother had tried to write the same character over and over again, each time stopping at the same stroke. What character? And why had she stopped in mid-flight? When Ruth was growing up, Her mother supplemented her income as a teacher's aide with side businesses, one of which was bilingual calligraphy, Chinese and English. She produced price signs for supermarkets and jewelry stores in Oakland and San Francisco, good luck couplets for restaurant openings, banners for funeral wreaths, and announcements for births and weddings. Over the years, people had told Ruth that her mother's calligraphy was at an artist level, first-rate classical. This was the piecework that earned her a reliable reputation, and Ruth had had a role in that success. She checked the spelling of the English words. "It's grapefruit," 8-year-old Ruth once said, exasperated. "Not grapefoot. It's a fruit, not a foot." That night, Lu Ling started teaching her the mechanics of writing Chinese. Ruth knew this was punishment for what she had said earlier. "Watch," Lu Ling ordered her in Chinese. She ground an ink stick onto an inkstone and used a medicine dropper to add salt water in doses the size of tears. "Watch," she said, and selected a brush from the dozens hanging with their tips down. Ruth's sleepy eyes tried to follow her mother's hand as she swabbed the brush with ink, then held it nearly perpendicular to the page, her wrist and elbow in mid-air. Finally she began, flicking her wrist slightly so that her hand waved and dipped like a moth over the gleam of white paper. Soon the spidery images formed. "Half off. Amazing discounts. Going out of business." "Writing Chinese characters," her mother told her, "is entirely different from writing English words. You think differently. You feel differently." And it was true. Lu Ling was different when she was writing and painting. She was calm, organized, and decisive. "Bao Bo Mu taught me how to write," Lu Ling said one evening. "She taught me how to think. When you write," she said, "you must gather the free flowing of your heart." To demonstrate, Lu Ling wrote the character for heart. "See, each stroke has its own rhythm, its balance, its proper place. Bao Bo Mu said everything in life should be the same way." "Who's Bao Bo Mu again?" Ruth asked. "She took care of me when I was a girl. She loved me very much, just like a mother. Bao, well, this means precious. And together with Bo Mu, this means precious auntie." "Oh, that Bao Bo Mu, the crazy ghost." Lu Ling started to write a simple horizontal line, but the movements were not simple. She rested the tip of the brush on the paper so it was like a dancer sur les pointes. The tip bent slightly downward, curtsied, and then, as if blown by capricious winds, swept to the right, paused, turned a half step to the left, and rose. Ruth blew out a sigh. Why even try? Her mother would just get upset that she could not do it right. Some nights, Lu Ling found ways to help Ruth remember the characters. "Each radical comes from an old picture from a long time ago." She made a horizontal stroke and asked Ruth if she could see what the picture was. Ruth squinted and shook her head. Lu Ling made the identical stroke, then again and again, asking each time if Ruth knew what it was. Finally, her mother let out a snort, the compressed form of her disappointment and disgust. "This line is like a beam of light. Look, can you see it or not?" To Ruth, the line looked like a spare rib picked clean of meat. Lu Ling went on. "Each character is a thought, a feeling, meanings, history, all mixed into one." She drew more lines, dots and dashes, downstrokes and upstrokes, bends and hooks. "Do you see this?" she said, over and over, tink, tink, tink. "This line, and this, the shape of a heavenly temple." And when Ruth shrugged in response, Lu Ling added, "In the old style of temples," as if this word old would bump the Chinese gears of her daughter's mind into action. Ping, ping, oh, I see. Later, Lu Ling had Ruth try her hand at the same character, the whole time stuffing Chinese logic into her resistant brain. "Hold your wrist this way, firm but still loose, like a young willow branch. Ayah, not collapse like a beggar lying on the road. Draw the stroke with grace, like a bird landing on a branch, not an executioner chopping off a devil's head. The way you drew it, well, look, the whole thing is falling down. Do it like this, light first, then temple. See? Together it means news from the gods.
See how this knowledge always comes from above? See how Chinese words make sense?
With Chinese words, her mother did make sense, Ruth now reasoned to herself. Or did she? She called the doctor and got the nurse. "This is Ruth Young, Lu Ling Young's daughter. We're coming to see Dr. Huey for a checkup at 4, but I just wanted to mention a few things." She felt like a collaborator, a traitor, and a spy. When Ruth returned to the living room, she found her mother searching for her purse.
"We don't need any money," Ruth said. "And if we do, I can pay."
"No, no pay. Nobody pay," Lu Ling cried. "Inside purse put my health card. I don't show card doctor charge me extra. Everything's supposed to be free."
"I'm sure they have your records there. They won't need to see the card." Lu Ling kept searching.
Abruptly, she straightened herself and said,
"I know. Leave my purse at Gao Ling house. Must be she forgot tell me."
"What day did you go?"
3 days ago. Monday."
"Today's Monday."
"How can be Monday? I go 3 days ago, not today."
"You took BART?" Since the car accident, Lu Ling had been taking public transportation when Ruth wasn't able to act as chauffeur.
"Yes, and Gao Ling late picked me up. I wait 2 hour. Finally she come. And then she accused me, say, 'Why you come early? You supposed to come here 11. I tell her, "No, I never say come 11. Why I say coming 11 when I already know I'm coming 9 o'clock? She pretend I crazy, make me so mad.
"Do you think you might have left it on the BART train?"
"Left what?"
"Your purse."
"Why you always take her side?"
"I'm not taking sides.
Maybe she keep my purse, don't tell me. She always want my things, jealous of me. Little girl time, she want my cheap hall dress, want my melon fruit, want everybody attention."
The dramas her mother and auntie had gone through over the years resembled those off-Broadway plays in which two characters perform all the roles, best friends and worst enemies, arch rivals and gleeful conspirators. They were only a year apart, 77 and 76, and that closeness seemed to have made them competitive with each other. The two sisters came to America separately and married a pair of brothers, sons of a grocer and his wife. Lu Ling's husband, Edwin Young, was in medical school, and as the elder, he was destined, as Lu Ling put it, to be smarter and more successful. Most of the family's attention and privileges had been showered on him. Gao Ling's husband, Edmund, the little brother, was in dental school. He was known as the lazy one, the careless boy who would always need a big brother to watch over him. But then big brother Edwin was killed in a hit-and-run car accident while leaving the UCSF library one night. Ruth had been 2 years old at the time. Her uncle Edmund went on to become the leader of the family, a well-respected dentist, and an even more savvy real estate investor in low-income rental units. When the grocer and then his wife died in the 1960s, most of the inheritance, money, the house, the store, gold and jade, family photos, went to Edmund, with only a small cash gift given to Lu Ling in consideration of her brief marriage to Edwin.
"Only give me this much," Lu Ling often described,
pinching her fingers as if holding a flea.
"Just because you not a boy."
With the death money, along with her years of savings, Lu Ling bought a two-unit building on Cabrillo and 47th, where she and Ruth lived in the top flat. Gao Ling and Edmund moved to Saratoga, a town of vast lawn, ranch-style homes and kidney-shaped pools. Occasionally, they would offer Lu Ling furniture they were going to replace with something better.
"Why I should take," she would fume, "so they can pity for me? Feel so good for themselves, give me things they don't want?"
Throughout the years, Lu Ling lamented in Chinese,
"Aiya, if only your father had lived, he would be even more successful than your uncle, and still we wouldn't spend so carelessly like them."
She also noted what should have been Ruth's rightful property, Grandmother Young's jade ring, money for a college fund. It shouldn't have mattered that Ruth was a girl or that Edwin had died. That was old Chinese thinking. Lu Ling said this so often, Ruth could not help fantasizing what her life might have been like had her father lived. She could have bought patent leather shoes, rhinestone-covered barrettes, and baby roses. Sometimes she stared at a photo of her father and felt angry he was dead. Then she felt guilty and scared. She tried to convince herself that she deeply loved this father she could not even remember. She picked the flower-like weeds that grew in the cracks of sidewalks and put them in front of his framed picture. Ruth now watched as Lu Ling searched in the closet for her purse. She was still pointing out Gao Ling's transgressions.
Later, grown-up time want my things, too. Want your daddy marry her. Yes, you don't know this. Edwin, not Edmund, because he oldest, more success. Every day smile for him, show off her teeth, like monkey.
Lu Ling turned around and demonstrated.
But he not interest in her, only me. She so mad, later she marry Edmund, and when you daddy die, she say, oh, so lucky I not marry Edwin. So stupid, she saying that, to my face. Don't consider me, only concerning herself. I say nothing. I never complaining. Do I ever complaining?
Ruth joined in the search, sticking her hands under seat cushions. Lu Ling straightened herself to all 4 feet 11 inches of indignity.
And now you see? Why Gao Ling still want my money? She crazy, you know. She always think I got more hiding somewhere. That's why I think she take my purse.
The dining room table, which Lu Ling never used, was a raft of junk mail. Ruth pushed aside the Chinese language newspapers and magazines. Her mother had always been sanitary, but never neat. She hated grease, but didn't mind chaos. She kept junk mail and coupons as if they were personal greeting cards.
Here it is, Ruth cried. What a relief.
She pulled out a green pocketbook from underneath a mound of magazines. As Lu Ling checked that her money and credit cards were still inside, Ruth noticed what had obscured the purse in the first place. New issues of Woodworking Today, 17, Home Audio and Video, Runner's World, Cosmopolitan, Dog Fancy, Ski, Country Living, magazines her mother would never read in a million years.
Why do you have all these?
Lu Ling smiled shyly.
First I thinking, get money, then tell you. Now you ask, so now I show you.
She went to the kitchen drawer where she kept years of expired coupons and pulled out an oversized envelope.
News from the gods, Lu Ling murmured. I won $10 million. Open and see.
Sure enough, inside were a sweepstakes promotion coupon that resembled a check and a sheet of peel-off miniature magazine covers. Half the covers were missing. Lu Ling must have ordered 3 dozen magazines. Ruth could picture the mail carrier dragging over a sack full of them every day, spilling them onto the driveway, her mother's hopes and logic jumbled into the same pile.
You surprised?
Lu Ling wore a look of absolute joy.
You should tell the doctor your good news.
Lu Ling beamed, then added,
I win all for you.
Ruth felt a twinge in her chest. It quickly grew into an ache. She wanted to embrace her mother, shield her, and at the same time wanted her mother to cradle her, to assure her that she was okay, that she had not had a stroke, or worse. That was how her mother had always been, difficult, oppressive, and odd. And in exactly that way, Lu Ling had loved her. Ruth knew that, felt it. No one could have loved her more, better perhaps, but not more.
Thanks, Ma. It's wonderful. We'll talk about it later, what to do with the money. But now we have to go. The doctor said we should still come at 4 and we shouldn't be late.
Lu Ling turned crabby again.
You thought we late.
Ruth had to remind her to take her newly found purse, then her coat, finally her keys. She felt 10 years old again, translating for her mother how the world worked, explaining the rules, the restrictions, the time limits on money-back guarantees. Back then she had been resentful. Now she was terrified. In the hospital waiting room, Ruth saw that all the patients, except one pale, balding man, were Asian. She read the blackboard listing of doctors' names. Fong Wong, Wang Tang, Chin Pan, Quack Ku. The receptionist looked Chinese, so did the nurses. In the 60s, mused Ruth, people railed against race-differentiated services as ghettoization. Now they demanded them as culturally sensitive. Then again, San Francisco was about a third Asian, so Chinese-targeted medicine could also be a marketing strategy. The balding man was glancing about, as if seeking an escape route. Did he have a last name like Young that had been mistakenly identified as Chinese by a race-blind computer? Did he also get calls from Chinese-speaking telemarketers trying to sign him up for long-distance calling plans for Hong Kong and Taiwan? Ruth knew what it meant to feel like an outsider, because she had often been one as a child. Moving to a new home 8 times made her aware of how she didn't fit in.
Thea start 6th grade? Luling was now asking.
You're thinking of Dory, Ruth answered. Dory had been held back a year because of attention deficit disorder. She now received special tutoring.
How can be Dory?
Thea's the older one. She's going into 10th. Dory's 13. She'll be in 7th.
I know who,
Luling grumbled. She counted, flipping her fingers down as she listed.
Dory, Fia, oldest one, Fufu, 17.
Ruth used to joke that Fufu, her feral cat, born with a nasty disposition, was the grandchild Luling never had.
How Fufu do? Luling asked.
Hadn't she told her mother Fufu had died? She must have, or Art had. Everyone knew that Ruth had been depressed for weeks after it happened.
Fufu's dead, she reminded her mother. Ay-ya!
Luling's voice twisted with agony.
How this can be? What happened?
I told you.
No, you never!
Oh, well, a few months ago she went over the fence. A dog chased her. She couldn't climb back up fast enough.
Why you have dog?
It was a neighbor's dog.
Then why you let neighbor's dog come in your backyard? Now see what happened. Ay-ya! Die no reason.
Her mother was speaking far too loudly. People were looking up from their knitting and reading, even the balding man. Ruth was pained. That cat had been her baby. She had held her the day she was born, a tiny wild ball of fur found in Wendy's garage on a rainy day. Ruth had also held her as the vet gave her the lethal shot to end her misery. Thinking about this nearly put Ruth over the edge, and she did not want to burst into tears in a waiting room full of strangers. At that moment, luckily, the receptionist called out,
Luling Young.
As Ruth helped her mother gather her purse and coat, she saw the balding man leap up and walk quickly toward an elderly Chinese woman.
Hey, Mom, Ruth heard him say. How'd everything check out? Ready to go home?
The woman gruffly handed him a prescription note. He must be her son-in-law, Ruth surmised. Would Art ever take her mother to the doctors? She doubted it. How about in the case of an emergency, a heart attack, a stroke? The nurse spoke to Luling in Cantonese, and she answered in Mandarin. They settled on accented English as their common ground. Luling quietly submitted to the preliminaries. Step on the scale, 85 pounds. Blood pressure, 100 over 70. Roll up your sleeve and make a fist. Luling did not flinch. She had taught Ruth to do the same, to look straight at the needle and not cry out. In the examination room, Ruth turned away as her mother slipped out of her cotton camisole and stood in her waist-high flowered panties. Luling put on a paper gown, climbed onto the examining table, and dangled her feet. She looked childlike and breakable. Ruth sank into a nearby chair. When the doctor arrived, they both sat up straight. Luling had always had great respect for doctors.
Mrs. Young, the doctor greeted her jovially. I'm Dr. Huey.
He glanced at Ruth. I'm her daughter. I called your office earlier. He nodded knowingly. Dr. Huey was a pleasant-looking man, younger than Ruth. He started asking Luling questions in Cantonese, and her mother pretended to understand until Ruth explained, she speaks Mandarin, not Cantonese. The doctor looked at her mother.
Guo Yu.
Luling nodded, and Dr. Huey shrugged apologetically.
My Mandarin is pretty terrible. How's your English?
Good, no problem. At the end of the examination, Dr. Huey smiled and announced,
Well, you are one very strong lady. Heart and lungs are great, blood pressure excellent, especially for someone your age. Let's see, what year were you born?
He scanned the chart, then looked up at Luling. Can you tell me?
Year?
Luling's eyes darted upward, as if the answer were on the ceiling.
This not so easy say.
I want the truth now, the doctor joked, not what you tell your friends.
Truth is 1916, Luling said.
Ruth interrupted. What she means is, and she was about to say 1921, but the doctor put up his hand to stop her from speaking.
He glanced at the medical chart again, then said to Lu Ling, "So that makes you how old?"
82 this month, she said.
Ruth bit her lip and looked at the doctor.
82,
he wrote this down. "So tell me, were you born in China?"
"Yes."
"What city?"
"Ah, just also not so easy say," Lu Ling began shyly. "Not really city, more like little place we call so many different names. 46 kilometer from bridge to Peking."
"Ah, Beijing," the doctor said. "I went there on a tour a couple of years ago. My wife and I saw the Forbidden City."
Lu Ling warmed up. "In those days, so many things forbidden, can't see. Not everyone pay money, see forbidden thing. You say this forbidden, that forbidden, charge extra."
Ruth was about to burst. Her mother must sound garbled to Dr. Huey. She had had concerns about her, but she didn't want her concerns to be fully justified. Her worries were supposed to preclude any real problem. They always had.
"Did you go to school there as well?" Dr. Huey asked.
Lu Ling nodded. "Also, my nursemaid teach me many things, painting, reading, writing."
"Very good. I was wondering if you could do a little math for me. I want you to count down from 100, subtracting 7 each time."
Lu Ling went blank.
"Start at 100.
100,
Lu Ling said, confidently, then nothing more. Dr. Huey waited and finally said,
"Now count down by 7.
Lu Ling hesitated.
92. Ah, 93. 93.
"This is not fair," Ruth wanted to shout. "She has to convert the numbers into Chinese to do the calculations, then remember that and put the answer back into English." Ruth's mind raced ahead. She wished she could lay out the answers for her mother telepathically. 86, 79.
80.
Lu Ling was stuck. "Take your time, Mrs. Young."
80, she said at last. "After that, 87.
"Fine," Dr. Huey declared, with no change of expression. "Now I want you to name the last 5 presidents in reverse order." Ruth wanted to protest.
"Even I can't do that."
Lu Ling's eyebrows bunched in thought.
"Clinton," she said after a pause. "Last 5 years still Clinton."
Her mother had not even understood the question. Of course she hadn't. She had always depended on Ruth to tell her what people meant, to ask her what they said from another angle. "Reverse order means go backward," she would have told Lu Ling. If Dr. Huey could ask that same question in fluent Mandarin, it would be no problem for Lu Ling to give the right answer.
"This president, that president," her mother would have said without hesitation. "No difference. All liar. No tax before election, more tax after. No crime before, more crime after. And always don't cut welfare. I come this country, I don't get welfare. What's so fair? No fair. Only make people lazy to work."
More ridiculous questions followed.
"Do you know today's date?"
"Monday."
Date and date always sound the same to her. "What was the date 5 months ago?"
"Still Monday."
When you stop to think about it, she's right.
"How many grandchildren do you have?"
"Don't know. She's not married yet."
"He doesn't see that she's joking." Lu Ling was like the losing contestant on Jeopardy. Total for Lu Ling Young, minus 500 points. And now for our final Jeopardy round.
"How old is your daughter?"
Lu Ling hesitated.
40, maybe 41.
To her mother, she was always younger than she really was.
"What year was she born?"
"Same as me, dragon year."
She looked at Ruth for confirmation. Her mother was a rooster.
"What month?" Dr. Huey asked.
"What month?"
Lu Ling asked Ruth. Ruth shrugged helplessly.
"She don't know."
"What year is it now?"
1998.
She looked at the doctor as if he were an idiot not to know that. Ruth was relieved that her mother had answered one question right. "Mrs. Young, could you wait here while your daughter and I go outside to schedule another appointment?"
"Sure, sure. I not go anywhere."
As Dr. Huey turned for the door, he stopped. "And thank you for answering all the questions. I'm sure you must have felt like you were on the witness stand."
"Like O.J.,"
Dr. Huey laughed. "I guess everyone watched that trial on TV." Lu Ling shook her head.
"Oh, no, not just watch TV.
I there when it happen. He kill wife and that friend bring her glasses. Everything I see.
Ruth's heart started to thump. You saw a documentary, she said for Dr. Huey's benefit. A reenactment of what might have happened, and it was like watching the real thing. Is that what you're saying?
Luling waved to dismiss this simple answer. Maybe you see document. I see real thing.
She demonstrated with motions.
He grab her like this. Cut neck here. Very deep. So much blood. Awful.
So you were in Los Angeles that day, Dr. Huey asked.
Luling nodded.
Ruth was flailing for logic. I don't remember you ever going to L.A.
How I go, don't know, but I there. Dis true. I follow that man. Oh, he sneaky. O.J. hide in bush. Later I go his house, too. Watch him take glove, stick in garden, go back inside, change clothes.
Luling caught herself, embarrassed.
Well, he changed clothes. Course I don't look, turn my eyes. Later he run to airport, almost late, jump on plane. I see whole thing.
You saw this and didn't tell anyone?
I scared.
The murder must have been an awful thing for you to see, Dr. Huey said.
Luling nodded bravely.
Thank you for sharing that. Now, if you'll just wait here a few minutes, your daughter and I are going to step into another room and schedule your next appointment.
No hurry.
Ruth followed the doctor into another room. How long have you noticed this kind of confusion? Dr. Huey asked right away.
Ruth sighed. It's been a little worse in the last 6 months, maybe longer than that. But today she seems worse than usual. Except for the last thing she said, she hasn't been that weird or forgetful. It's more like mix-ups, and most of it is due to her not speaking English that well, as you may have noticed. The story about O.J. Simpson, you know, that might be another language problem. She's never been good at expressing herself.
It sounded pretty clear to me that she thought she was there, Dr. Huey said gently.
Ruth looked away.
You mentioned to the nurse that she had a car accident. Was there a head injury?
She did bump her head on the steering wheel. Ruth was suddenly hopeful that this was the missing piece to the puzzle.
Does her personality seem to be changing? Is she depressed, more argumentative?
Ruth tried to guess what an affirmative response might indicate.
My mother's always gotten into arguments all her life. She has a terrible temper, and as long as I've known her, she's been depressed. Her husband, my father, was killed 44 years ago, hit and run. She never got over it. Maybe the depression is becoming worse, but I'm so used to it, I'd be the last one to notice. As for her confusion, I was wondering if it was a concussion from the car accident or if she might have had a mini stroke.
Ruth tried to remember the correct medical term.
You know, a TIA? So far, I don't see any evidence of that. Her motor movements are good, reflexes are fine, blood pressure is excellent, but we'll want to run a few more tests. Also make sure she's not diabetic or anemic, for instance.
Those could cause problems like this.
They could, as could Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia.
Ruth felt her stomach had been punched. Her mother wasn't that bad off. He was talking about a horrible terminal illness. Thank God she had not told the doctor about the other things she had tabulated. The argument her mother had had with Francine over the rent, the $10 million check from the magazine sweepstakes, her forgetting that Fufu had died.
So it could be depression, Ruth said. We haven't ruled out anything yet.
Well, if it is, you'll have to tell her the antidepressants are ginseng or po-chai pills.
Dr. Huey laughed. Resistance to Western medication is common among our elderly patients here, and as soon as they feel better, they stop taking it to save money.
He handed her a form.
Give this to Lorraine at the computer station around the corner. Let's schedule your mother to see the folks in psychiatry and neurology, then have her come back to see me again in a month.
Around the full moon festival.
Dr. Huey looked up. Is that when it is? I can never keep track.
I only know because I'm hosting this year's family reunion dinner.
That evening, as Ruth steamed the sea bass, she told Art in an offhanded way.
I took my mom to see the doctor. She may have depression.
And Art said, So what else is new?
At dinner, Lu Ling sat next to Ruth.
"Too salty," she remarked in Chinese, poking at her portion of fish, and then she added, "Tell those girls to finish